We just finished Western States 100, and we talked in our last podcast to Jackie Merritt, 7th place finisher, F7, and she talked about how Tailwind Nutrition was integral in her success at Western States.
There was a lot of adversity out there. I mean, a lot of people with the heat and the snow and the humidity, everything was thrown at those runners, but she relied on a stable, reliable source of fuel.
And you don't want to take and throw more variables into a crazy day like it was at Western States.
So if you want to avoid gut bombs and you want to stay upright on your feet, go to
tailwindnutrition.com.
Aftershocks, bone conduction technology.
I was just up at Forest Hill talking to some fellow runners.
And Scott, you could have had your earbuds on and talked to them because this is the way you stay open to your environment.
But we were just sitting there around talking, watching runners go by, and they said, "Hey, what kind of headphones do you use?" And I said, "Oh."
Did they really say that?
They actually said
that. You're not making this up?
I'm not.
Okay.
And I said,
because it sounds staged.
I said, "Hang on just a minute." I ran over to my truck and I pulled out my Aftershocks Trex Titanium and I said, "You got to try this." As soon as I brought them out, the guy says, "Are those bone conductive headphones?" And I said, "Yeah." And his wife had no clue what they were. And
right.
I said, "Put these on your head." And she goes, "These are really weird." She put them on my head and on her head, and I hit play. And she was blown away.
So your eyes just open up and your mouth kind of opens up.
They did.
Does sound come out your mouth when you open it up when you're wearing bone conductive? That's what
I want. If you have it turned up loud enough. Aftershocks, they've been a great partner of Trail Runner Nation. And we see a lot of them out on the trail now. Mm-hmm. You can get a deal if you go through our partners page. Go to trailrunnernation.com, go to partners page. And if you buy them through the link there, you get a free Trail Runner Nation buff with your purchase of the Trex Titanium.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast with me, a complete imposter here in London, England, and your two real hosts over there with a skeleton behind them very early morning in the studio. It's Scott and Dom.
All right, we ready?
Yeah.
There's a bunch of, like, old brothel hookers, like, buried out here.
But I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys have won a couple of awards, and
I've never prepped for a podcast ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing.
Okay, we'll clear that up. That will, the group of the nation and podcast downloaders are very sophisticated.
They are.
They're unlike any other group out there. They're tolerant. They ignore our many imperfections, and they'll be able to substitute the word. No problem.
They will.
All right. Are we ready?
Yeah.
Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott War.
I'm Don Freeman, and today we have on Stephen Shorten, and he's, we captured Stephen. Well, I better just might as well be honest with this. I have a nephew that knocked on my text and said, "Hey, you got to talk to Stephen. I got a buddy, and he works over at Ultra, and he's a shoe designer."
Your cousin told you that?
No, my nephew.
Oh, your nephew.
Yeah.
How does he know?
Well, he knows Stephen.
How does he know Stephen?
Well, we'll get into that.
I didn't know that there was a connection.
Well, I kept that from you, Scott.
Oh, that surprises me.
Only things you need to know. And there's nothing more I like than talking about shoes. And I think for most of us as runners, we have an intimate relationship with that thing between the ground and our feet. And those are shoes.
Well, so, there's only a few things we can spend our money on as runners.
Oh, no.
We don't have kayaks. We don't have these $1,000 bicycles.
Well, Stephen, I know we have you on the line, and Scott and I are holding a wonderful conversation between us. But, Scott, there are many things to spend money on. A watch, a hat.
Some shorts.
Glasses, yeah. Race entries. I mean, it goes on and on, right? Stephen, welcome to the podcast. We'd like you to join Scott and I in this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
How do you know Don's nephew?
You know, actually, we live in the same town and attend some of the same kind of church groups, and we're both artists of a sort. So we just got hooked up together that way.
So what kind of, I know he paints, and he's very skilled. What type of art are you in? Because that really matches closely or is a correlation with what you're doing over there with Ultra.
Yeah, actually, more of a designer, I guess, than an artist. And but we both use a lot of the similar programs, and they're very visual languages. So we kind of both, understand, the same visual languages and same struggles, I guess, sometimes. But they're a little different. They're a little different.
So let's talk about shoe designing, because there's a lot to look at. You go into a store and there's just shoes everywhere.
Well, time out. I want to know about Steve. Steve, you're an artist. How come you're working for a shoe company? What is your title? Are you a shoe designer, engineer, artist? What are you?
My title is like footwear designer. Yeah.
So how did you get into that?
You know, it's interesting. I guess I've always loved footwear, but I'm not really like a traditional sneakerhead, right? A lot of people, a lot of my friends who have gone into footwear design, they always loved like Air Jordans. You know, they were the next Jordan. That's what they loved. I never played basketball, never followed any of the Jordan line. I know about it now, but my Jordans growing up were all snowboard boots. So I loved snowboard boots. And, you know, then once I got to college, I liked art. I wasn't sure if I was a good enough artist to be like a portrait painter, but I always loved geometry and I loved, drafting. And so I had that, I think I had that kind of inclination. And then I ended up, hearing about a design contest that was sponsored by DC Shoes at the time. And I loved that brand. And it was just to design, the next pair of snowboard boots. And it seemed really interesting. So I entered it and had a lot of fun in that contest. And I think that's kind of what piqued my interest. And from there, after having some success in that contest, I then enrolled in the design department or the design program, I should say, at the college that I was at. And that's sort of where it started. Yeah.
Are you a runner? Do you have a background in running?
No, I don't. I mean, actually, I was not much of one. I was a swimmer growing up. So I swam year round and I played water polo. And then I did run cross country, but I just joined cross country to meet a girl. That was
of course. Yeah. That makes complete sense.
Let me find out what kind of runner you were. Did you catch her or did she get away?
All right. Well, so I mean, it was I cheated even on the mile, right? Fifth grade. I mean, I only ran 3 out of the 4 laps, right? And because I was starting to get lapped. And so, and this is kind of a running joke too around the office. But so as I was starting to get lapped on that third mile, I figured I could just kind of finish with the pack. And then I would just tell the gym teacher, hey, just tell him a random time. And so he asked, he said, wait, did you run 4 laps? And I was like, sure, whatever. And, I'm like 9. And he said, oh, what was your time? And I had no idea what was a good time and not. So I just said, I don't know, 7 minutes. And for a 9-year-old, like later on, I just thought, okay, I'm done with it. A year later, I'll have to do this again, but I can, put this off for a year. Well, he printed out the best times of the grade, and it turns out I was the fastest runner.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it was definitely not what I was intending. But then, so I was definitely not a runner growing up. Then in 10th grade, just to meet this girl, I joined cross country. I didn't even have running shoes. I had a pair of DC skate shoes. And so I went out and I thought, well, okay, how far do you have to run? And they said, well, it's like a 3-mile run. And that just seemed like an eternity. But I was like, all right, well, for swimming, we would swim easily 3 miles in a day, sometimes 4, sometimes even 5. And so I was like, all right, well, I could probably do that. And so I kind of plotted out this 8-mile run that I was going to practice with near my house in these skate shoes. And just to sum it up, I ended up falling into like a construction pit along the way, almost got lost in the cornfield. And then a buddy of mine picked me up in his truck and dropped me back off at home. But, I did end up meeting the girl. We went out a couple times, didn't work out, but I stuck with cross country and my times actually started going down after she rejected. So
did you ever hit that 7-minute mile mark? That's what I want to know.
Honestly.
Barely. Yeah, I did, but.
And then let me ask this question. The obvious one that pops into my mind is you're preparing for, a 3-mile run, and you go out and you practice an 8-mile run. I mean, I like the ultra mentality.
In skate shoes. Yeah, in skate shoes.
And I'm going to have to draw the obvious correlation here. Skate shoes are relatively flat, right? There's not a lot of, they're a flatter shoe.
Zero drop. It was just prepping me. You know?
Yeah, that's perfect. That's perfect. So it was a good choice.
Did you ever upgrade from the skate shoes to a running shoe, or did you always stick with what you knew?
No, I did. And so actually what's kind of funny about that, my first shoes that I got were a pair of Brooks Tsunamis. Uh-huh. And I think now you can't really find much on the Tsunamis. I think they ended up going to like the T-Series. So I think they're, I don't know what they're on, like the T8 or T9, but yeah, it was a great shoe. My first shoe was the Brooks. I always loved Brooks and, still do. I think Brooks makes a great shoe. And as far as comfort goes, and then I had a pair of Reebok DMX my senior year, and those were pretty sweet too. I ended up giving them to a bum. he needed them more than I did. So
let's talk about shoe design a little bit. Are we ready to move on, Scott?
No, I want to know how he got into being a shoe designer. I mean, I assume he was being humble. You won the contest with DC, right?
Of course, yeah.
You said you did well. I am assuming
I did.
Won.
I was really surprised that I won it because I look back at the stuff that I submitted and I don't even show anyone. It's so bad, you know. It's like, you know, it's so bad. I mean, there were actually a few kind of innovative ideas with it. But visually it wasn't good. And I don't know, maybe they were just being nice when they gave it to me, but there were quite a few entrants, you know, I think between 1,000 and 2,000 people that entered.
Wow.
And so that's really what kind of got me interested in actually thinking, wow, I could actually make a career out of this. And so then when I entered the design program at BYU, I was really excited for it, and the professors wanted absolutely nothing to do with footwear design, and so that was kind of a letdown. So I went through all 4 years of the design program, and I wasn't sure if I'd be able to get back to footwear because, you know, I really didn't have a lot of interest in designing the next microwave or the next you know, like cell phone or anything. It was, I'd always wanted to kind of just do footwear. And I got, I had a job. So right after college, I'd had a few different job offers that I almost took and then I turned down. And then one came up in Logan, Utah. And during the interview, they said it was at a place called Icon Health and Fitness. And I'd always wanted to live back in Utah. I loved it. I love it here. I'm from Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And, so I wanted to live out with them, you know, where the mountains were. And at Icon Health and Fitness, during the interview, they said, yeah, we're also in the process of acquiring a footwear company. And so then I said, okay, I'll take the job. And so I had to design treadmills and like exercise bikes for 2 years until the acquisition kind of finally went through, but it was worth it.
So this is really your first job out of college?
No, actually, I had also worked at another place. I had a job offer in San Diego designing cell phones. I didn't take it. And then I worked at another place here in Logan, designing, of all things, like baby supplies and baby equipment. And that didn't go well that wasn't really a good combination for either party. I have a farming background. And so I think it was when I proposed like a unique milking system for women.
Wait a minute. Okay. Can we just take that soundbite and replay that? You developed a unique milking system for women.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I thought it was actually pretty innovative. It was pretty cool. So,
well, I'd like to be on the innovation team there. All of a sudden, I'm very interested in becoming a designer. Forget shoes. So you're developing some milking systems. Portable, non-portable, for public use?
Highly portable. Probably not great for public use.
Right.
But, I mean, it was just, I didn't expect to hold the job very long.
I expect you to get arrested.
No, it was a pretty ingenious system. You know, you could hook up these breast pumps to a breast pillow, and you could just sit there and watch TV or whatever. And you know, but like I said, I grew up taking apart like silicone milk inflations for cows, and so I figured, you know, I could apply that now to, you know, to humans, and it just didn't go over well. And right after that, and it was really just kind of an interim job anyway.
Although developing breast pumps, probably one of the, if I did a podcast and they said you have to do it until you talk about breast pump development, I would figure I would be doing it for 1,000 years.
No way. We get it done in the first like 5 minutes.
Especially with a shoe design guy, you have to, if you put all those variables in line, maybe it would be a millennium that I would have to do these podcasts. But talk to us about shoe design. How does a shoe get designed?
So there's a couple different.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple different ways. I mean, you know, as far as the actual technical design, that's kind of one discussion that we can have. And then as far as, you know, what is the process that we go through on designing? I would say there's kind of a 4-step process that we use to get footwear designed, right? And I'm actually the 3rd step in that 4-step process as the product designer. And it first starts as kind of like the first step would be merchandising, right? So if you have a product merchandiser, they're really the first step in the 4-step process. The next one's probably the product line manager. The 3rd person is myself as the product developer or the product designer. And then the 4th is the product developer. So in that 4-step process is kind of how we narrow down what types of shoes we're going to design. And so that's kind of an interesting discussion. Do you want to start there, or do you want to talk more about it?
Yeah, let's go to step one, and then let's just take a shoe, for instance. Can we just, the shoe that you started out in development, maybe the Superior, right? That's a shoe. How did that come to fruition? How did the minds at Ultra say, you know what, we need a new shoe? And how did that happen?
Let's try the I haven't worked on
how
the
about
Superior
the Mountain MT
for a few years.
Mountain MT.
All right, so let's do the King MT. Yeah, so we did you know, the merchandiser we have a merchandiser here, and one of the big trends that was sort of happening in the industry was new compounds, right? Where Adidas had the Boost, you know, Nike had Lunar Lawn, and you know, there are a number of companies all now that have just different midsole compounds to sort of promote. Well, we needed that as well, and we wanted to come out with 3 shoes that had like a new compound, that had a new and we call it Ego. And so one of the shoes in there would be a trail shoe. We were going to do, the plan was to do 2 road shoes and 1 trail shoe. And one of the road shoes is another one that I did called the Escalante. But the trail shoe, what we looked at is the merchandiser first said, okay, hey, you know what? Mud runs are trending. And so is new comp, you know, so is like our new compound midsole. So is there a way that we could maybe try to capture some of that energy in a shoe, whether it's an existing shoe or in a new shoe? So that's what the merchandiser does. They find these trends, and then they get together with the product line manager.
Okay. Hold on 1 sec, yeah. Steven. So we have a merchandiser, and he's kind of the guy out there with his ear to the ground saying, you know what? People are doing a lot of mud runs. People are doing
market research.
They're just taking in what people are doing, and now we need to try to fit them with that concept or that shoe.
Yep, exactly. And so they find, and not just what's trending, but also what's kind of dying out. Some trends are kind of dying out too. And so he identified a couple of different trends as far as mud runs and then new compound shoes. And so then they got together, he got together with our product line manager, Todd Falker, and together they sort of devised, you know, where, like, what they do is the product line manager understands our entire line and every single shoe and its reason for existence, right? So you may have 10 shoes in your line, and each one serves a unique purpose. You don't want the same, you know, two shoes doing the same thing. Otherwise, they kind of cannibalize each mm-hmm. other. And so the product line manager has to make sure that any new trends that we're going to infuse into the line, that they don't, one, wreck something that might be working really well. And then, you know, as far as like changing maybe an existing shoe, right? And then if we're going to capture some other new trends, if some of these new trends don't really work to kind of integrate into an existing shoe, then we will create a brand new shoe for it. And so we make sure that there's space somewhere in the line. So you kind of keep slicing the pie a little bit thinner every time you add a new shoe. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. Because you do want a pretty diverse line that can capture a number of different runners and situations. And so our product line manager and our merchandiser got together and they said, all right, we need a mud run shoe. And then they began to, you know, write a brief and they said, hey, we could also put the new compound midsole on this. So what is it that's not only going to be unique to our line, but also unique to the industry? And so they came up with a shoe that really is pretty neat. Like, it's pretty neat. And it has, you know, it's got really big lugs on it. So it's basically a Salomon Speedcross outsole built kind of onto a Minimus upper. And, you know, like a New Balance Minimus upper. And then it has a really unique, highly responsive midsole to it. So it's kind of like if you took a really thin Boost midsole, Boost-like midsole, I would say, put it on a New Balance Minimus upper, and then put a Salomon Speedcross outsole on it, you basically have kind of the ultimate mud running shoe for Ultra. And it's really unique in the industry, and it won an Editor's Choice Award from Men's Health this year. So
you guys are very aware of your competitors and some of the attributes of each one of those shoes, because you're just listing them off like you're very familiar with some of the benefits or qualities.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I'm, like I said, I'm a huge fan of the designs of a lot of different brands out there. I think that each brand out there is doing something really well, you know.
So the between the merchandiser and the product manager, they come up with the idea that we need to come up with a shoe that will meet the need of a growing population, mud run.
Exactly.
Then they come to you, Mr. Designer, and say, okay,
make it.
Is that or they say, make it, and here are some of the compounds that we want you to use in this shoe.
Yeah, as far as compounds go, that's a little bit more on the back end. Myself and a product developer, who's step four in the process, a lot of times we'll find more emerging technologies and some of the technical, I would say, actually materials involved. We're more involved in the composition of the materials than they are on the front end. But they will, like you guys kind of hit it on the head, they will write a brief for me and they'll say, specific dimensions, and you know, so they may say, okay, we want 5.5 millimeter lugs on that, and then we want you know, it can't weigh any more than this, you know, maybe it's got to weigh 10 ounces or 8 ounces, or you know, I just did a shoe that is less than 4 ounces, right? And so, you know, there's quite a few different you know, criteria that they'll give me, especially like hard numbers, I would say, right? So weight, cost, dimensions. So they give me kind of that. And from there, I take all of my knowledge, not only in kind of, you know, having a background in art and design, but also in manufacturing engineering and footwear design and development. And I try to embody 3 to 5 concepts that all meet the criteria of what they're looking for.
Stephen, do you actually build the shoe and make it, or do you just take a piece of paper and draw it up the way that you see it? How does that look, entry?
There's a thing called a CAD program.
A CAD program?
A CAD.
Oh.
CAD.
All right.
Computer-aided drafting.
Is that what you use, Stephen? I was going to let Stephen answer that. I mean, all, the rest of us knew that, Scott.
You're doing good.
He's good, actually.
And so, I'll make at least half of it, right? So now let's kind of, we'll go into my step, right? Which is step 3, and we can kind of go a little bit deeper into that. So the first thing that I'll do is I'll read everything out. And then where you start in footwear design is with something that's called a last. And I don't know how many of your listeners know what a last is, but it's basically kind of like a mannequin, right? But it's shaped like a foot, right? And so every company has a different sort of foot form that they design shoes around. And we here at Altra, we have maybe a dozen lasts, maybe a little less than that. And that's really where you start, at least on the upper, like the sock part, we call it the upper, but that's really where the upper pattern starts. So I'll start sketching over a last, right? Not only in 3D, but also just hand thumbnail sketches with a pen and paper, just kind of see what's working, what's not. And then I'll take it into usually a computer program once I get some more refined ideas. And then this isn't real common with a lot of the larger companies, but I myself usually try to build a lot of my own midsoles and outsoles in CAD. And then we'll 3D print them here at Altra, and we'll take a look at them and make sure that, because there's a lot that you can learn in 3D and holding something that you'll just never really see it in 2D, even with a real trained eye, you still miss things. So I will build at least half of it. And then the upper usually is done in China, and then they send back kind of some fitting samples for us.
How important has 3D printing become in manufacturing and design?
Well, it's interesting, right? 3D printing, it's kind of cliche to say it, but it really is going to be the future. So it aids us a lot more so in the prototyping of a shoe as opposed to the manufacturing. We really don't do a lot of the 3D printing yet. There are a few companies out there. Adidas right now with their Futurecraft series is doing 3D printed midsoles that are pretty cool. Under Armour's doing it. And there's even some other footwear companies right now that are doing it too. But there is a difference between prototyping and manufacturing. And in prototyping, it's basically just making models, right? So we can grow, like a midsole that's pretty flexible and you can wear it on your foot. You wouldn't want to go running with it because it would probably destroy it. But it gives you at least an idea of proportions and just sort of the underfoot feel. So it's really changed a lot of, I would say the time that it takes to develop a pair of shoes from weeks at a time. Because it used to be that they'd probably have to cut a mold out of, either Ren, which is it's kind of like clay, but it's a little different. Obviously, it's just for holding and kind of looking at and holding in your hand to something that we can actually start to wear extrapolate a lot more information. So you definitely are learning a lot more information on the front end of the prototyping and early design phase.
Are the lasts that you use at Altra unique to Altra? I have an idea that all the shoes for the last 50 years have been the same last. It's the same shape, and that's why all traditional shoes are all the same shape because they're using the same last.
It's interesting. Like there are every company has. I mean, it's part of their. I would say kind of the special sauce, right? The secret sauce of every company. Each company has unique lasts, but I would say the vast majority of the companies out there have followed a really similar trend that they. It's been kind of fashion first and function second. And if you really look at, you look at a lot of the design philosophies from some of the great designers, like I think it was Le Corbusier that said, form follows function, right? But I think in footwear, they kind of, especially right now, they've really kind of gotten the cart in front of the horse and they're trying to make a shoe look extremely fast and, make it look really sleek and downhill. And I get it, right? Because that's kind of what people want to have on their foot, but our feet are not like aerodynamic, sharp little things. You know, we don't have like tentacles on the end of our feet like an octopus. We have kind of a big frog-like appendage there, you know, that's got 28 bones and it's got like 100 some muscles and tendons, and it's a very complex thing. And you add on top of that that we've been evolving for, you know, centuries to walk, you know, a certain way. And biomechanically, I think a lot of the last kind of, they don't aid in how we've evolved. And so Ultra is an extremely unique last, not only in, I guess, a little bit wider of a forefoot, but our lasts are also what we would call zero drop. And so your forefoot and your heel are actually on the same level as if you were kind of standing barefoot. But, I mean, there's plenty of arch support in there. We even have shoes that are more guidance shoes. So if you are a little bit of an overpronator, you can have a little bit more support, a little bit more guidance. But it's they're extremely unique lasts, for sure. Nobody else in the industry really has a last that looks quite like ours. There's a few that are getting close. Even in China, I was talking to one of our developers the other day, and the people at the factory, they call it the big baby head last, you know, because it's so top heavy. And we all got kind of a chuckle out of that. So they're very, you know, they're a little bit bizarre looking, but they're very comfortable.
Who's responsible for the King MT's color, or you name the shoe? Whose desk does that sit on? Is that yours?
Sometimes I did do the Kings, and color is something that's really jumped around quite a bit at our company. From time to time, we have different colorists that take care of things, and and I'm not even just speaking about Ultra. I think at a lot of different companies, they never trust the actual footwear designer to do the color. They'll go get a focus group of crackheads and homeless people and crazy people around town to get, you know, to pick colors for them. And then when that falls apart, then they come back to the designers to pick colors. A lot of companies that are bigger will have an entire color department. And we don't here at Ultra. So it's a little bit a committee. And then we do contract a colorist out of Portland as well to kind of do some stuff from time to time too.
Yeah. So on that subject, who then is responsible for the Velcro on that shoe?
That was me.
That was me. Well, good. Let's talk about that Velcro. Why'd you choose Velcro, Steven?
You know, okay, so and that was I had to fight. I had to fight Brian Beckstead, the president, and I had to fight Todd Falker, the product line manager.
And now you're fighting me. So let's talk about the Velcro.
sure, yeah. You know, the Velcro, I knew it potentially could be a pretty polarizing thing, but in a mud run and you know, an environment where you're doing a lot of fell running, there's certainly a lot of torsion in, different forces that are acting on your foot. And normally I wouldn't have put it on there, but our last being so spacious and a little bit more roomy, even on some of our other shoes where you're not doing fell running, I've had shoes turn almost completely sideways on my foot before if they get wet. And so you mix a kind of a wet environment where your foot may be sliding around a little bit, where you're going up and down hills, and oftentimes obstacles, especially downhill, more so than uphill. A lot of people tend to slide forward in the shoes. And so I added that Velcro strap not only as a cage for downhill running and to kind of keep your foot secure, but also as kind of a lace stay. So that, you know, if you look at a lot of the Solomon Speed Crosses, they have kind of a pocket where you can actually tuck that click lace in, which is ingenious. We didn't have that as part of the design. And so I created a Velcro strap. And it was also one other way to sort of differentiate it visually from the Superior. Because otherwise people would have thought, hey, you know, it's probably too much of a Superior. What's the difference between that and the Superior? So there were a number of different reasons why I put the Velcro strap on, and I've heard quite a bit of good things about it, but I'm totally open to people that don't like it.
Now, Steven, I'm going to be one of those people that do like it. I just want to give you a hard time.
Oh, you
no,
do? Okay.
I, I like the lateral stability that it gives going downhill. I mean, it does have that nice quality, but I do feel a bit like I belong in a retirement community when I hit that strap on there and Velcro my shoe on.
Yeah, well, it's always in development, and I knew, like I said, I knew it'd be polarizing because, you know, what's the only other one really that has the Velcro
SAS,
out there? Like
the SAS. It's the shoe that is
the Brooks Addiction.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the shoe at the retirement community.
Now, I
have a question about changing the shoe, changing shoes.
Yeah.
Why does that happen? We find a shoe that we're very, very happy with, and it evolves, and we weren't ready for it to evolve. Talk just about mm-hmm. why companies move shoes around and make different designs.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a good discussion. So I think, you know, I was kind of having this discussion the other day with a coworker, and I said, it seems like, you know, companies that keep certain models of footwear the same, you know, I'm talking kind of about like the Cascadias, mm-hmm. the Speed Crosses, a couple of those, for example, or even, you know, if you go over to the road, you look at, I think Brooks has done a good job slowly evolving their Go series. You know, it usually feels the same, or Nike's got the Pegasus, mm-hmm. right? And they've done a good job with those. The footwear that seems to stay the same and this is just my observation, right? But it seems to happen when a shoe hits three criteria, right? People like how it looks, they like how it feels, and they like what it costs. Mm-hmm. And a shoe can even be a little bit deficient in one of those areas if it makes up in the other two. So for example, if you have a piece of footwear that maybe you don't really love how it looks, but you love how it feels, and it's the right price, you'll probably buy it, you know? Or if you maybe you love how it looks and you love how it feels, but maybe it's $10 or $20 more, you'll probably buy that too. The shoes that tend to change, they change sometimes in the process, I think, breaks down, not so much in the design, but it happens more in step one and two of that process, when either the merchandiser, for whatever reason, feels that maybe it didn't hit the right target, or the sales weren't as good as what they wanted, and then the product line manager and them get together and they say, hey, maybe we need to change something, right? And so usually it's pretty rare for the footwear designer to actually change something so wholesale and it not get caught, right? It has to be approved by those other entities, those other kind of departments, in order for it to go out the door. And now if you have, you know, there's been some footwear, I can speak, I guess, specifically maybe about some ultra models. There have been times, you know, if you have any questions about that, but as a general rule, it's usually not the footwear designer that ever changes anything. We kind of just follow the orders of, you know, the marching orders of the product line manager and then the merchandiser. Now, we should speak about step four of that process too, because there are also times when we are trying to keep, a model the same, but we may switch factories and they end up using, you know, different foams or they use a little bit of a different process. But I think what you're probably trying to get to is not so much like slight subtle tweaks, but more wholesale changes when it's more of a revolution on a shoe as opposed to an evolution. And usually I would say, you know, it's probably more in the breakdown between maybe the product line management as they review some of the new designs, and then that gets approved and let out the door. That's probably where I would say some of those end up changing, a shoe pretty drastically.
When, you know, Ultra is known in the industry and has become known for at least two unique attributes: a very wide toe box, a foot-shaped toe box,
foot-shaped toe box,
and a zero drop. Are those two attributes something that are unchanging when they come to you with a new proposal? When the merchandiser and the product manager come to you and say, we want to develop a new shoe, are those things that are unbreakable, or do you have the freedom go ahead?
Yeah, I think that'll always be part of Ultra. I think that's the essence of what we are, because our philosophy is really not to try to, you know, our philosophy is to not impede, you know, the human body, which we feel is already, you know, it's evolved for, you know, centuries already, millions of years, you know, however you want to look at it, to do a certain thing, and that's to run in a certain way. So our philosophy is only to aid in that. I think we'll always be foot shaped and zero drop.
Speaking of shoes changing, how much input does a designer get or whatever team from customer feedback? You know, you go onto a website and you can read how they rate the shoes. Does your day start with reading reviews from customers? Let's start with that.
It can. I mean, that's always helpful. We look at customer feedback. We look at feedback from, especially from athletes and our testers as well. You know, I was just this morning, I was looking at the pair of shoes. It's a newer model that we're coming out with called the Timp. And Jeff Browning sent us some photos, and he was, you know, he was the top 10 finisher at Western States. And so he was just showing us some different wear areas, and we're like, okay, we got to fix that area. So we look at wear testing, feedback online. Feedback online is a little bit less objective because it could just, you never know. You have no idea who the people are that are writing that. So you filter. I think it's good to have a lot of information, and then you can kind of filter it down. But we receive a lot of different information from different channels, whether it's wear testing, whether it's reviews online, that can be helpful. Sometimes that's less objective, though. You just have no idea who exactly it is that's writing that. But you filter it, right? And you evaluate what it is that they're saying. And it's the worst thing you can do as a designer is get defensive over something, right? And you have to be objective about these things and say, hey, if people didn't like that, then you know, don't take it personally. Let's just make the best product that we can. And you're also never going to please everyone. But, you know, if it's universally uncomfortable or if it's somewhat universally, you know, disliked as far as aesthetics go, or the ergonomics maybe aren't working and in a pretty bad way, you have to fix it. And, you know, it's just part of the job.
Steven, I also work for a manufacturer, and I'm curious, when it comes to shoes, what is the maturity rate from idea, conception, through design, through having your athletes out there testing and making changes, and then till finally it hits the store? How long is that cycle?
Our development cycle, we try to do like an 18-month development cycle. So that would include probably the first 3 to 4 months of just me working out the design, and then maybe within, I would say probably the first 6 months, you should probably have a sample that works pretty good so that you can wear test it, you can evaluate it, and then you can work out whatever kinks there may be with those samples, and then also start working on colors and everything else. So within the first 5 to 6 months, you should probably have, you know, a working sample. And then, you know, I think you get like the first 90% of the way done in the first 6 months, and then the next 6 months is really working out some of the kinks and, you know, if you have to do any running changes on a sample. But it takes a long time. You know, footwear is, there are so many, you know, parts involved in footwear, because you gotta, you know, you realize there's a left and a right shoe, and then you have multiple sizes, and then you have multiple colors. And then in that same model, you also have women's sizes as well. So we end up making thousands of different pieces of different materials, all just for one model of, you know, one model of shoes or whatever, because you got to consider how many sizes there are, how many colors there are of that one model. And then you also have men's and women's. And sometimes what works well on size 10 doesn't work well on size 10.5, because whether the artwork got skewed or it's not fitting or it's fitting too long. So it's really like herding a lot of cats.
I never really thought about a shoe that's size 5 compared to the shoe that's size 15, that design just doesn't work on a 15, or I can't see it on a 5.
Oh, yeah. And it's actually one thing that's funny at Altra is, you know, Golden Harper is very integral. You know, Golden Harper is the one that started the company, and he has a little bit of a different philosophy, I think, in a lot of ways. Even some people, you know, like myself, I have my own philosophy, I think, as far as some design things and what looks, you know, a shoe that's a size 15 does not look like a shoe set, you know, a size seven shoe, proportionally. And you would think that it kind of would, but our smaller sizes tend to look a little bit thicker, and our longer sizes look a lot faster due to the way that we grade our shoes. And it, so, yeah.
Is Golden one of your key testers?
He is. He always gives feedback. We have so many different testers and feedback, and Golden is he's taken quite a few different roles. Obviously, still in the company, he's obviously, I would say, he's our most aggressive tester, which I like. You know, he'll go, and when he runs, you know, 10 miles in a pair of shoes, it looks like someone else ran like 60 miles in it, because he's just, I mean, he's probably one of the most aggressive downhill runners that you'll ever come across. And he also, you know, he'll take some aggression out on the shoes, you know, like if you put something on there that he doesn't like, he'll run it till it breaks off. And then he'll say, see, I told you it wouldn't work. And my job is to prove him wrong and, you know, make it work. So
did you have to fight Golden on the Velcro?
No, actually, Golden is a very progressive thinker, and he's not afraid to do something that looks a little bit different. He's a very function first, before form, before aesthetics. And so him and I, you know, we certainly talked about that, and it wasn't a unilateral decision by myself, but he's totally open to doing very unique things like that. And so I didn't fight him at all. It was really more entities in the company that wanted, they were, I would say, more accustomed to a traditional aesthetic, and they were a little bit afraid of that. But, you know, it's funny. I think we're probably one of the few trail shoes out there that have a Velcro strap right now. And then just recently, Nike came out with a lot of their LeBrons that have, you know, Velcro on them. And
you're setting a trend, Stephen. Hey, let me ask you, how many miles do you design a shoe to last? I mean, we hear all kinds of numbers, and let me preface that by saying, you know, you're heavy runners, and they're with different gaits. There's so many variables in there, but across the board, your mid packer, your average person, how long should a shoe last?
Well, I think I've heard the golden number of kind of like 400 miles.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, but I think you hit the nail on the head of, obviously, some shoes maybe are only designed, like back in the day, Nike had like the Mayfly that was only supposed to be designed and run, I don't remember how many races, but it was supposed to just fall apart after, I think it was less than 100 miles or whatever. And it was just a pure race day shoe. I think for us, we try to say around 400 miles is really what we test for.
Now, you mentioned earlier you developed a shoe that was 4 ounces. Is that shoe coming out on the market? Should we look for it?
It is, yeah, actually. I designed it kind of with a lot of the feedback from Zach Bitter. Uh-huh. And it's sort of it's a race flat, and I'm excited for it. I just got back from Asia working on it, taking more out of the shoe, as far like unnecessary weight. And so I'm really excited for that one. It's called the Vanish. So
very cool.
Excited for that one. Yeah. And I even named that one too. So I was happy that my name got through.
What are some of, without divulging any confidential information, what are some of the other new shoe designs that you're working on, if you can share?
Oh yeah. I mean, like, we're always looking at our line. Where can we slice the pie? You know, we do have, a couple new trail shoes, one new trail shoe. I didn't work on that one, but that one was run by Jeff Browning. He ran that, and also Lone Peak 3. He kind of ran a couple different shoes, but it's a little bit more cushion than the Lone Peak, and a little bit less than the Olympus. And so we have that trail shoe coming out, but we have then the race flat as well that I'm real excited for. So we got some new shoes, but we also are working on, you know, I'm working on like the Lone Peak 4 right now that comes out in spring of 18. And that one is by far the most, you know, complex ultra that I've ever made. And it's meant to be a very subtle evolution off of the Lone Peak 3.5. But I think just some of the feature set and everything, it's taking everything that was good all the way from the Lone Peak 1, 2, 3, 4, and all the 0.5 models. And just we're going to integrate it all into the 4. So that's the one I'm probably most excited about right now.
At what point do you continue to use a good-selling shoe name like Lone Peak or getting and coming out with a completely new name? So the Lone Peak, the original Lone Peak and I would assume the Lone Peak 4.0 are completely different shoes or very different shoes.
They are, but I think what I did is I tried to actually get back to that original shoe a little bit more, trying to kind of get back to the roots a little bit. And then what's interesting, too, is sometimes the shoe, it has to evolve a little bit because we're trying to maybe, you know, when you look at Ultra, when it first came out, right, that shoe was basically the only trail shoe that they had. And so it had to, you know, meet quite a few different customers. Now that we have a Superior below it and two, you know, and a King MT below it, and then we also have a couple of other trail shoes above the Lone Peak, it has become something that's slightly different. But Golden and I worked pretty well, I guess, together on this one to try to actually get it back closer, especially in outsole traction, to what the original Lone Peak was, and I think with the feel of it as well. So the name itself, did that answer some of the question?
Yes.
Okay, hey, good.
Hey, how many shoe designers show up in the morning at Ultra?
We only have two designers here.
Huh.
And then we just hired an intern recently, so it's been... So when it first transitioned over, when we acquired Ultra, they had a few different models, and that was it. The first shoe that I designed ever in my life, but then also for Ultra, was the Ultra Threesome. A great name, you know. But I don't know if you guys remember the Ultra Threesome.
No,
I don't.
Didn't make much of an impact, I guess.
Yeah, well, it was a triathlon shoe.
Oh, that's why.
But it was a really cool shoe. It was like a sock upper, similar to kind of a Zoot. And then from there I worked on, I did the first Olympus. And then there were times when I would just do the midsole and outsole and the other designer did the upper. And for a little while, I wasn't even on all of the shoes. Sometimes I was, you know, on shoes at all. Sometimes I was back on exercise equipment. And then probably 4 years ago is when they put me full time on shoes again. Hey, so, yeah.
If a guy or a gal is listening and they're thinking, I love shoes. How do I get involved in it? What, you're in the industry and you have some young person saying, how do I get involved? Whether it's in the design or manufacturer, you know, name any of those three spaces, or just a rep going out. Do you have any advice for somebody that wants to wrap their world into shoes?
Yeah, I, for sure. And I think it even includes people that maybe aren't that artistic. There's plenty of room on a footwear design team, for, you know, in R&D for people of a lot of different skill sets. But if you want to be the one that's actually kind of designing the shoe, I would say, you know, the first thing is just sketch a lot, right? Mm-hmm. Educate yourself on kind of what shoes are, what the history of footwear is. And then most footwear designers that I've met who have been, you know, successful have kind of gone the college route. And we usually get degrees in a couple fields. One of them would be, first and foremost, industrial design. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people haven't heard of heard of industrial design. I still tell my dad after 10 years what I've done, and he thinks I'm a graphic designer or like a graphic engineer or industrial. He just doesn't know. But
is he wearing Ultras when you're explaining this to him?
He has
okay,
Ultras.
Good. Okay, good.
Multiple pairs. Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, you're good. So a lot of us get degrees in product design or industrial design. Some get it in architecture. I've known people that have had illustration degrees, graphic design degrees. Some may not even have a degree at all. But typically, probably your safest bet is to look for a college that has an emphasis in product design and or fashion design. But fashion design can be a little bit different. Make sure that they do footwear, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so get like typically an undergraduate in product design and then work as much as you can on just sketching shoes and learn. If I said only learn two or three programs, I would say learn Rhino, which is a 3D CAD program, and learn Photoshop and Illustrator, especially Illustrator. But all those three programs are kind of the three staples in the industry that footwear designers use to visually communicate their designs.
Would factories and coworkers. Would cartoonists become good shoe designers?
You know, I'll tell you what. I was in the industrial design program at Brigham Young University, and we oftentimes had classes that would overlap with the animators, and they were incredible artists, right? Especially some of the concept artist kids. So yeah, I think they could definitely be good footwear designers. What I've noticed though is it's not so much the concepting that people aren't good at. It's really more of step four, which is product development after product design. And it's really kind of the nitty gritty type, making patterns and, you know, making molds and stuff that sometimes I think would probably bore an animator or would bore a concept artist, because it's when you really have to make the stuff real. It can't just exist in a 2D realm on a screen. And so trying to bring it to life, sometimes it can get a little bit boring. I get bored with it sometimes too, often, but you have to do it. So yeah, a cartoonist could definitely be a good footwear
designer. I'd say pull the guy that's doing Speedy Gonzalez over to your team. And
or Roadrunner.
A Roadrunner, exactly. Hey, yeah. Steven, it's been enlightening, you know, talking about shoes. We spend an enormous amount of time making the selection, searching for the right ones. They've got to look fast. They've got to be comfortable. They have to be in the right price range. And ultimately, they have to be the flag you like flying. You know, we always go to the brand we like best, whether it's Nike or New Balance or Ultra or, you know, what have you. So I've enjoyed this discussion.
I was going to say, Don and I both have connections in Cache Valley, Utah. Maybe we need to make a field trip, research field trip. TRN field trip.
And there's a bit of a mountain there. You guys have the Wasatch Front that the bear is running, and a few other
Wasatch 100.
Yes,
we do. Yeah, actually, you guys come on out, and I'll do like a good 3 mile run with you.
Yeah, cutting the last mile probably.
I was gonna say, you'll only do three laps.
Exactly.
But
that's
seven.
Right.
Reported 7 minute miles.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Hey, Steven, thanks so much. Keep cranking out the product there. We enjoy it, and we appreciate the insight and taking us on a tour of what a shoe designer does.
And we love talking about shoes. So this was a fun podcast for us.
Yeah, let's do this again.
So go out and run
in Ultras
Moss. Correct.